I've got the footman, Cameron, on the line. Cameron, thank you so much for joining me today.
No problem.
So I really kind of regarded sneakers as a new age invention, but they have quite a long history. When was the first instance of a sneaker?
Well, sneakers are really about 200 years old.
Wow.
If the truth be told. And that they were canvas-topped, rubber-soled shoes. They were actually developed in order that working-class people could go and enjoy standing on the sand, hence the name sand shoe.
That's where it comes from.
But because they also allowed you to cross surfaces and not make a sound, they were very quickly picked up by the criminal fraternity and dubbed sneakers.
No, so there actually is a reason that they're called sneakers. How?
Absolutely.
That's blows my mind, because I've always just kind of thought, oh, that's a weird name to call a shoe. But anyway, so have sneakers or sand shoes always been a popular type of shoe, or have they been quite specific to groups?
Well, they really were cheap and available, more or less, and so therefore they appealed to people who couldn't really afford to have anything else. Obviously, again, round about the late 19th century, when organized sports became very much the fashion in North America and elsewhere, it meant that the fans would actually look to what the shoes or the superheroes of the games were wearing. And in particular, the name that comes out is Chuck Taylor, who played baseball. And subsequently, he was called Chucks. And Converse realized that, in fact, there might be a market potential there. And so subsequently, they matched him with the shoe. And lo and behold, after a sticky start, Chucks took off. And subsequently, no self-respecting teenager in the 50s, male anyway, would be without their Chucks. They're all stars.
That's incredible. Yeah, because I know that the Converse especially, every time I've done like a weird school play where you have to dress up as a 1950s character, they always say Converse. What do you think has kind of been the key for Converse specifically to stay around so long as a brand then?
Basically because it's association with celebrity and obviously the idea that that has mass appeal to what was in the 50s a very much new and thriving market, and that was teenagers. So for the very first time after the Second World War, teenagers across the Western world had disposable income and were very easily influenced by the media, Hollywood and records, rock and roll. Also, the tempo of music had changed, and that meant that in order to be cred on the dance floor, you had to have the shoes that would allow you to trip the light fantastic, and what better to have than rubber-soled canvas-topped shoes.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, Converse, I mean, I don't regard them as much as a sneaker. Like, when I think of sand shoes or sneakers, I think of, like, you know, the ones that I put on when I'm going to go play a game of netball or something. So how did the kind of design kind of changed from the Converse, which were now, it's kind of more like an everyday shoe, to the sand shoes and sneakers that we see now?
Well, again, it's really the influence of sport. More or less, the high tops, which is really the basketball and baseball boot, is predominantly thought to have been more protective of the ankle. And so, therefore, they had a much greater attraction to those that were interested in that particular sport. When I was a kid back in the 50s, you could tell the difference between kids who would go for tennis shoes, which are the low trainer kind of shoe, or basketball shoes, which in fact were hip and trendy, and the kind of shoe that Elvis Presley wore, for example. Whereas your cooler sort of Hollywood set, like James Dean, would prefer to be seen in their tennis trainers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is kind of like a style choice almost. So you mentioned that the high tops were thought anyway to kind of give more protection to the ankle. When did kind of pediatrics kind of really influence the design of a shoe?
Well, there's been some stops and starts in that particular area. Once sport really became the sort of vision of television and so forth, then there was an awful lot of interest in the key players and what they were wearing, and obviously lists of injuries and all that type of thing. So once you get Mike Jordan involved and all that kind of sort of that focus of attention, the end result is that you start to look at the number of injuries he might have and the shoes he was wearing when he had it. In truth, there is very little orthopedic or mechanical advantages given over to shoes, contrary to the marking rhetoric. In other words, what happens is that they would go with the colour of his Porsche rather than any significant change in the design of the shoe that would create a mass production problem on the line. So in other words, they would tell you it was getting better and it was much more scientific, but in essence, there has really been very, very little change in the design of trainers in the last 150 years. Now, things have slightly changed in the recent times because now the records are beginning to be broken, particularly in marathon running. But effectively, it's still the outcome is still unsure as to whether this has been contrived in order to make sure that the company that has invested millions in the product actually is as efficient as the marketing people claim.
Mm. Well, I can't wait to see what happens in the next 20 years. Maybe we'll have some flying sneakers or something. Cameron, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.